I know.
All right, we are in 1 Samuel chapter 14, I think it is. No, 13. And for those of you who may not have been here last week, and by the way, you didn't get it, for some reason, Donna carrying the little recorder back, hit the button, started recording, but when it starts recording again, it erases.
Oh.
So last Wednesday nights was not on there. It was erased.
There's been other ones that I've tried to listen to, and I get like it stops after 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
Should. Okay.
So I kept forgetting to contact
this thing. Yeah, sometimes I don't know what this does. Anyways. Yeah, if that happens, please let us know that something's messed up.
I have to do it over, but it won't be the same.
Yeah, I've done those where I sat at my desk and tried to do it again. I go, oh, this is terrible. But anyways, usually Donna listens to the whole thing because she's not in here with us. Usually on Thursday morning she listens to the whole thing to make sure it's there. But, so if that happens, please let us know. If we don't get it all on the computer, let us know. All right, so anyways, the 13th chapter, and we talked about Saul. He's entering into the time where you might even begin to say he's forgotten what God has done. And he's warned about this by Samuel later on in his ministry. But the other thing is, Samuel is who Samuel is, and Saul is who Saul is. And somehow Saul thinks that he has to do everything. Or that he even, you might even put it this, that he's even authorized to do everything. Yet he knows better, and in this occasion we find where the Lord, through Samuel, had told Saul to wait. And he gets to the place, there's going to be this battle, he wants God's blessing. Who doesn't want God's blessing? Okay? But Samuel said, you wait for me to get there, and I'll do what needs to be done, in order that we might ask God to bless what's going to happen. Well, Samuel tells Saul, how many days did he tell him to wait there, remember?
Seven
days. And don't do anything until I get there. Well, the 7 days happen, and we don't know if it's the morning of the seventh day or the morning of the eighth day, we don't know, or in the middle of the seventh day. But Saul says, you know what? It's getting tight here. I've got to do something. I think we always have to be careful with that attitude. I've got to do something. I think sometimes we have a sense of urgency that maybe the Holy Spirit doesn't have. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
These things are happening. Doesn't God realize these things are happening? So he doesn't seem to be moving fast enough, so I need to take the bull by the horns, and I need to do. And how many times we do that and just mess up the whole situation? And remember, we as believers, part of our faith has to be that we believe that God is always right on time. And that he does not work according to our clock. So, you know, if God is leading us into doing something and stuff, or he's in a process. Very rarely, I think, does God ever give us the whole scenario at one time and then say, hey, go do it. Because I don't think he ever wants us to just go do it. I think he wants us to walk in faith during the whole process. Which means sometimes in that process, we may have to wait upon the Lord before we take the next step. But again, we are very impatient. I say we're the microwave generation, probably more than any other generation. If we don't get it in 15 seconds, it's not gonna fly. And we have so many things that do that to us. As these things right here,
mm-hmm.
You know, we get mad at people if they don't answer this right away. Not even knowing what's going on in their life, what's going on at that time. Or if they don't call us back in a little bit, you know, you didn't call me back 10 minutes. What's going on? What's happening? You know, with my kids, when I paid for theirs, they better answer when dad called. I just remember life was even, not too many years ago, life, you know, getting a mortgage on a house, you could expect to wait anywhere from 2 weeks to a month. You expect now to get an answer on a mortgage in a house in 30 seconds. You put that right in that computer and stuff like that and stuff. And, you know, even when I was first entering the pastorate and in the full time, we had what they call those, you remember those digital pagers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you got those, you had to stop at a payphone, which is a foreign thing to this generation. You stopped at a payphone and you called in when you could find a payphone. There were many more payphones that day, but there was, again, there was no expectation. He may call, you know, my pastor may call in an hour, maybe 2 hours, so he's near something, maybe very quickly, but you never knew. But so everything is, and we do that with God too. We think everything has to change instantaneously and be made right from our view instantaneously. We have to be careful because we are probably the most inclined generation to get out ahead of God, to try to make something happen because, you know, to wait. We would have trouble being Moses. I would. Think about it. How much trouble would you have being Moses? Mm-hmm. Three great events in Moses' life, and they were separated by 40 years at a span. We have this idea when we read the book of Acts that the wonderful, glorious things that God did in the book of Acts, and there are so many wonderful things he did, that they happen every 15 seconds. And yet, that's not true. They're over a span of time. We read something in the Bible, and we think, oh, well, I read it in 30 minutes, so it must have happened in 30 minutes. And you don't realize it. It could have been spans of years. So, to learn to trust God in his timing and to wait upon God may be the hardest thing we do in this generation. It's hard for me. You know, how many of you ever asked God for patience? Yeah, we're not going to go that direction, huh? So, you know, he may take you down a road that you don't want to go. But anyway, so Saul did not have patience. And so in verse 10, where we got to last week, I think we got to 11, but we'll go to verse 10. It says here that, so it happened as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offerings, guess what happened? Samuel came. I mean, you talk about timing. Just as soon as this is over, the point is, if he had waited another couple hours before he started, I'm sure it took a couple hours to do the whole process and stuff, but if he had waited another couple hours, Samuel would have been there. Now, what does this decision do? What is the consequences of this? What is the consequences of, and do you believe that there are actual consequences when we try to get out ahead of God and do things that we're not called to do, in a way and even in a time? The way may not even be the issue here. The issue may simply be time. And when we get out ahead of God and do it before him, it is an expression, somehow an expression, that we're really not trusting God. You can do it all right by method. You can do it all right. But if we do it all right by method, and God says this is not the time for this to happen, is that not just as much disobedience as doing it all wrong by method? Both of them require following God, listening to God, obeying God, and trusting God. So, are there consequences for when the children of God do this? You're going to see there's some consequences of Saul. What about for us? Okay.
Hopefully not quite as serious as his consequences.
This is pretty strong. It reminds me of the statement to whom much is given, much is required. So the consequences for someone who's been put in a position, a God-called position of leadership, that's not fair. I always hate when people that say that's not fair. It's like they're the ones judging what's fair and what's not fair. But there is, if you're in a position of leadership, there's a higher amount of accountability. That doesn't make your sin, quote, greater or less than someone else, in the sense of before God being greater. But you know, if you're called to be a leader of people and you commit a sin, the same sin that someone who is maybe just out there on their own doing, it's the same sin. But the impact of that sin is certainly greater. So people have difficulty with it when they say, well, you teach that all sin is the same. Well, I don't really teach that. What I teach is all sin is sin. And all sin is disobedience to God. And all sin has consequences. That's what I teach. Okay. And all sin left without the blood of Jesus Christ, even what we call the littlest of sin, will cause you to spend eternity separated from God. In that way, all sin is sin. But we all know that some sins have greater consequences than other sins. And we can add to that, the person who does it, depending on what the call is upon their life, that too may have greater consequences than if somebody who does not have that position, you know, may not have the same consequences. I think about pastors who have fallen. Okay? that not only impacts them, as same way as any Christian who falls would impact them and their family. But when you have pastors who fall, you have a bigger family that's impacted by that. You know, and you have a lot of innocent people saying, well, I thought, and, you know, how could that happen? And little kids who trust, I follow two pastors that have done that as a pastor in those churches. It's the hardest thing to bring healing into those churches and stuff, so.
Another thing is false teachers. Like, I think of Joseph yes. Smith. I mean, look at the impact he has had on the cult.
Yeah.
Around the world, really.
Around the world. They have just about as many Mormons today as there are Southern Baptists. Both are around, depending on who you listen to, both are around the 13 to the 15 million number. Started from some, I want to say crazy guy, but I almost want to say just possessed guy who said he listened to an angel who gave him another gospel. And from that, we have this craziness that's going on today. And that's, you know, in my Tuesday morning class, we're finishing up on Jude. I talked about that, you know, Jude says that we need to contend earnestly for the faith once and for all given to the saint. We're not called to say, you know what, to give them the platform. I'm not saying we're told to get in a fight and argument and stuff like that. But if the church, the true church, says, you know, of the apostate church, even here in Fountain Hills, and we say, you know what, we're not going to say anything. And I've had pastors like, you ought not to say anything about that. I said, well, brother, what are you called for? So you're okay with him teaching these things. Well, I can't have any, you know, impact on what he says. No, but you can have impact on those who listen to what he says and who listen to you, and you can clearly identify to them there's a difference between what he's teaching and what the Bible teaches. But if you just keep silent, you're giving him the platform unopposed. We are called to contend for the faith. So you can't, I've been pushing on Sunday morning, what we believe. You can't be ashamed. We can't be ashamed. We can't be silent anymore. Because we tell the world that what we believe means nothing. Okay, so Samuel shows up. Verse 11. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, now Saul's good. This is not the first time he said, Saul is good about making excuses for what he did, rationalizing what he does. He didn't say, here's what he didn't say. Oh no, I disobeyed you and you spoke the words of God, and I am broken and humble before God, and I'm sorry. That's not what he said. What he says was, when I saw that the people were scattered from me, which was what was happening. They were starting to get restless and fearful and you know, where's the prophet? The prophet hadn't showed up yet. So again, what Saul says, well, you didn't show up. Basically, you didn't show up, so I'm going to do what I can do to keep this army together. Okay? And that you did not come within the days appointed. So again, so what's he doing? He's blaming the restlessness of the people along with the failure of Samuel to be there when Samuel said he would be there. Now, please remember, they did not have planes that flew in on a scheduled time. It's just, you know, I'm sure Samuel said, I'll be there in 7 days. What does that mean? Clearly, in the way they traveled on that day, you would have to say, around the 7th day, sometime I'm going to be there. Okay, yeah. But whatever, you wait. Okay, so he starts by saying, well, the people were restless, and then you didn't show up the way that you said. And I also saw that the enemy, the Philistines, had gathered here. Okay, so he's saying I had to do something. You need to understand the situation. You ever talk to God that way? God, you really need to understand this situation I'm in. And so let me clarify it for you, because apparently you don't understand what's going on, or you wouldn't leave me like this. Now, I know we wouldn't say that in that way to God, but sometimes we do in our actions. We say to God, you know, apparently, God, I need to clarify it. As if I'm really fearful. A lot of people see God as this old man sitting on a throne up there. Doesn't quite get it. He's wonderful, he's powerful, and he's loving, but he doesn't quite get it. So he needs us to clarify things for him. You know, and once we clarify it, then finally God will see it the way we see it, which, by the way, is the right way to see it. Okay? That's the way a lot of people approach it. But that's Saul's response to Samuel. You know, he's fearful that his army's leaving him. He's upset that Samuel did not show up in the time that he should have showed up. And then he's also filled with fear that the Philistines are getting stronger day by day as they're gathering the stuff. You know? So what if it was God's plan? I just told this. What if it was God's plan to let the Philistines get as strong as they could get? As big as they can get. To get all their armies there. What if that was God's plan? So in that moment, when a faithful, obedient king is led by God's man, Samuel at that time, under the power of the Spirit of God, that day, what if that day was a day if Saul would respond, that God would have annihilated the Philistines? How would that impact history? What if? But you know the what if was taken out of the way because Saul decided he would do it himself. We never know. You know, we want to respond. You know, the Bible says we're supposed to walk by faith, not by sight. So we always want to respond to the stimuli that comes as, and we want to say, well, I've got to get on this and get this done. Or the enemy could get stronger. They could be more equipped. They could, you know, we look at all those things, and it may be God saying, no, you calm down, because I don't want you to do anything until the enemy gets at maximum strength. Because I want to show you something. It's kind of like you go back to the book of Judges and a man by the name of Gideon. And that's the story there. Well, the Gideon starts with what, 30, what is it, 30,000? Okay?
Yeah.
And God says, you know what? That's too many. Because you're going to defeat, I'm going to give you victory. I'm already telling you, yeah, I'm going to give you victory over the Midianites. But if you go with 30,000 guys, you're going to say we did it. So let's clean this herd out. So he gets it down to 10,000. And God says, nope, that's still too many. So what's the number he finally gets it down to?
300.
300. To where it would be humanly impossible for them to destroy the Midianites. That's the point. And it's my point so many times that we as a church do what we can do from our giftedness, our talent, our resources and stuff like that. And sometimes we step ahead of God and do it according to those things. And I really believe we miss out on God doing something supernatural beyond what we can do. We need wisdom, I understand that. We need to make decisions according to resources. I understand all those things, but what if God says, I'm going to do something bigger than you ever thought of, and all I'm asking you to do is trust me. But God, we don't have this, we don't have that. They're bigger. I wonder how many times we miss in the modern day church the supernatural work of God because we push him out of the way, just like Saul did. We push him out of the way and try to get it done ourselves because we think if we don't get it done now, it's not ever going to happen. Any thoughts? Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if you tell this story, but I just had a recent experience of that. I've had it on both ends of the scale of that, but just recently when we went in this little camp, it happened to be the exact week of VBS, and so, which was here, and then, but Neville had told us about this kids camp in up north, and I just knew the Spirit of God was telling me I need to go. So I got released from doing this here, and then I went. But you know, I have a lot of physical issues. I mean, I have a lot of my knees are bad, back, all this stuff. And it's a kids camp. Well, I end up just saying to them, like, I'm probably not gonna be good as a one-on-one because you know I'm gonna ruin this kid's time because I'm not gonna be able to do all these activities. But just let me, you know, I'll do whatever God has me to do. So it's like we get there and the day of. They say we need somebody to be with kids. We need one more person. A kid showed up on the bus and like, that's got to be you. And I'm like, okay. So I said, I hope it's a slow kid. So the first thing this little girl gets off the bus and she runs up to me and goes, do we get to run? I can't believe I just from that point on I just said, Lord, whatever you put in front of me, I'm gonna do. And I can't believe the things I was able to do.
That's amazing.
I was like, my knees, I couldn't even hardly, I was having all kinds of issues. I was going to get cortisone shots. I was running, playing games. I was going on hikes. I was playing these games, and these kids are going, "Man, you're good," you know. Fast, and I'm like, who is this person? I had a different body. I did, and then I came home, and I came back to my old self again. I was freaking snapping. But honestly, it's like. It was, you know, God, I said to God, okay, whatever you give me to do, I'll
what a,
do.
What a great word. I mean, that's, you know, I just wonder how many times, you know, some people say, well, so what? But that's not a so what. It's a huge thing. And it's such a something we have to hear as a church that as a whole we begin to approach it that way. God, what do you have for us this year? What do you have for us to do? You know. And as our committees meet, as our mission work, our budgeting, all these things meet and stuff, we want those people to seek the Lord. What do you want us to do this year? You know, and I just think, I fear how churches have learned to do it is we decide what we think needs to be done, and then we tell the people what they need to do in response to that, and then we ask God to bless it and pray afterwards. It's not really, first of all, say, God, what would you have us do? Mary.
But you know the graciousness of God.
Oh, yes, of course.
And we've had so many reports, for example, from some of the women who have gone on the Haiti trips who had multiple physical problems, and they just vanished for the time they were
yes.
there.
Yeah.
I had a relative who was who went on a mission trip to Romania, and he had such terrible allergies. He was constantly in trouble here, allergies that turned into asthma all the time. And he went over there. He ran out of his medicine. He never had a problem the whole time he was working in Romania. When he came back, allergies right
yeah.
there. I mean, God just does it.
We should he never come home, is what you're saying.
What? He calls you, and he equips you to do what he's
That's exactly right. We have to believe that. And in the time he wants it done. I mean, that's the part that I think we struggle with. I mean, we struggle with all of it with faith. I understand it. But I think we have an easier, okay, God, I need you to equip me to do this. And we know, we pray that. But very rarely do we say, God, what is your timing? And am I willing to wait upon God to move before I do it? But yeah. Go ahead, Laura.
Mary reminded me, because before I left, I said, I'm believing in 2 Corinthians 9:8, where he says, God is able to make all grace abound to you, having all sufficiency in all things and all times, that you may abound in every good work. So I said, well, that's the verse I'm going on. I don't have kids. I raise cats. I don't know anything about them. So that's what I'm relying on. Whatever you do, you know, these are foster kids. These aren't the easy ones, okay? And I got that cabin full of them, so. And he did. He just made all the grace.
Of course, I got the two golden boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
All right, so.
Well, I think on a smaller scale, it's going to happen too. You're up early in the morning, you worked all day, you're just dog tired, and all of a sudden you get talking with somebody about the things of the Lord, and then you can't get to sleep. You're just all wound up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. When we talk on a personal thing, especially, we need to just be sensitive to what the Spirit's doing around us. Because He's always at work around us. It's not that He's lacking in His work. It's we that are lacking in being responsive to Him. So, you know, to look for those God moments, those God times, for those opportunities and stuff. But again, even in those, don't get out ahead. You know, I gotta give them the full load here about the gospel. Well, maybe you do and maybe you don't. That's why I tell people we're not out here pushing a methodology in sharing the gospel. That doesn't mean the methodologies themselves are bad. Maybe God will have you use something that you learn to share. The four spiritual laws. I'm just use that as an example, okay? But some people say that's all they do. It's four spiritual laws. They're in everybody's face with four spiritual laws. And I think we need to walk in such a way with the Spirit and try, because He may have you just say to that person that day in that place something, you know, God bless you. That may be it. He may not have you give the whole gospel presentation, or He may have you give the whole gospel. It's being sensitive to the Spirit. We have to believe that God is working, the Holy Spirit's working enough that He at the same time is working in those people that He's brought us into our path. I think that's how He works. I think that's how He works all the time. So, all right, so you see Saul's response. Now go to verse 12. Then I said, this is what he said. Then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal. By the way, that's, I put a little map up here. that helps you, that Gilgal would be right in this area. Okay, so he said that he would come down to me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. Now, let's jump to this just a moment. What we have moved to, and Saul doesn't seem to get this yet, what we have moved to is we have moved from worship and a legitimate, now what makes a legitimate offering legitimate? That it's biblical. Okay? So what we have moved to is from a place of genuine worship and a legitimate offering to an attempt to appease God, to get him to do something. That's what superstition is. That's what witchcraft does. That's what all these people around them have done. It's like carrying the ark into battle. I carry this ark into battle, or if I offer this offering to God, then somehow God is obligated to give us great victory. Now God, first of all, we need to learn, God's not obligated to do anything from our perspective. The second thing we need to learn is you can't appease God. You can't buy him off. You know, if I do the right thing, then God will do that. That's a real problem with the modern day prosperity, health, wealth, and prosperity. They teach their people, if you do this, then God must do that. So who's in control of that? You are. Which is folly. We're not in control of much of anything. Try breathing without God. Tell me how much control you actually have. So when we think about this, this trying to appease God to get him to give us what we want. When we teach biblical giving, I hope we don't teach biblical giving to say, well, you give so you get back from God. Giving is a privilege and an honor that God would use us in anything in life. What he does in back is what he's about. We don't give to get. Because if we give to get, we've missed it. It's the same thing. We don't serve in order to get something back. We serve because it's God's call upon our life. We don't share, so if someone responds to us, we share because the Lord led us to share. And once again, leave the results of that sharing in God's hands.
So you're giving what's his, not ours.
Exactly right. That's true whether we're giving financially or giving of ourselves. Because what's the Bible say? You have been bought with a price. You are no longer your own. He owns you. Okay? So everything that flows out of us needs to come with that attitude. It's his. I'm his. So
do we have this concept of I'm a self-made man? Who gives us the talents to do anything?
Yeah.
You know? Because where it comes to my attention here is felt. Therefore, I felt compelled.
Felt, yeah.
You know, I mean, isn't that our society now?
That's the whole. I was reading. Cliff put something up today about five signs that your church is heading in a progressive direction. I read all five of those things. And we're not heading that way, guys.
We're not
heading that way. But one of them was that you respond according to how you feel rather than responding according to the truth. And that's where we are today. Everything's feeling today. Everything's feeling. You know, from just everything. And particularly when you talk about the progressive, they base everything upon what they feel is right for that situation. Not on an objective source of truth that has already declared what is right. That's exactly what Saul did. I mean, he said, I felt compelled. You want to say, okay, Saul, where'd that feeling come from? Go ahead,
the
Dan.
ASB has, I forced myself.
I what?
I forced myself.
Yeah. But what drove him? Everything that he speaks of here that drove him was himself. He can talk about the people scattering. He can talk about Samuel being late. And he can talk about the forces of the enemy going great. But he made the determination this is what needed to be done, rather than trusting God. All right, let's read on. It says, verse 13, and Samuel said to him, you have done foolishly. How can Samuel talk to the king that way? You know, he didn't call him a name, but he spoke to him the truth. And sometimes we're fearful of speaking the truth. And I've had people say, well, you have no right to say that to this national leader, or say that about this national leader. So I didn't call him names. I wasn't cruel to him. I just said he was wrong. He's leading people in an ungodly way. That's what I said. And you, who are you? I get that a lot. Who are you to say those things? You know, and I said, yeah, it's what he's done. It's evident what he's done. So and so Samuel said, you've done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord, for which he had commanded you. Now the Lord would have, now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. It's an interesting thing here. This, you know, we know that God knows the end from the beginning. But notice who Samuel puts a responsibility on for what has happened here. God wants to, I want us to get this in our head. We know that. We know history, and we know the end results. We know who comes after it. We know all of those things, okay? But in real lifetime, there's no way that anybody could have known that unless God had, you know, shown through the prophet and stuff. But certainly Saul didn't. Saul responded to when Samuel said, you're going to be the king of Israel. That's how it happened. Saul didn't come saying, I need to be the king, okay? So everything in that is legitimate. That's what I want you to see. God didn't call Saul to be king and to play with him. God called Saul to be king, which would have meant that his line would have carried on. Okay? It didn't take long in Saul's thing for him to show that he was not kingly material. Because if you notice here, it has more. David wasn't a perfect man. Everybody understand that. But what does God say about, when you look at these two guys, the problem is Saul's heart. And the answer is David's heart. And it's not that David always did the right thing. I mean, he was guilty of murder. Okay? Adultery, murder. He was a bad father. Yet God talked about his heart. Right from the beginning here, we see that Saul's heart is not at a place of desiring to follow God in obedience. You read some of the Psalms that David wrote about obedience and his own personal struggle with that and stuff. You see his heart there, even though he had to acknowledge that he didn't always do the right thing.
Neither do we.
Well, that's true. But what you see in David is when he did the wrong thing, time and time again, he was responsive to the corrective hand of God, which told you something about his heart. Whereas Saul, when he did the wrong thing and God brought correction, Saul began to blame everybody else. And then tried to rationalize that he did the right thing, even though it was clear that he did the wrong thing. Okay? And so now Samuel says, listen, God would have made you your king over Israel and your family forever. God wasn't playing games with your family when he called you. But you've made a decision that you're not going to be obedient to God. And it's, again, I want to say to you, it's not just a matter that he did one act of disobedience. It's the whole scenario here. He was disobedient. He would not listen to correction. He blamed other people. And then he tried to justify his disobedience as being the right thing to do. And all of that is what collapsed the kingdom of Saul and his family. Yeah.
When he started this way, and we'll find out that it multiplies. That foundation is being laid now. And it's no different than lying. The more you lie, the easier it becomes.
The more you disobey, excuses, or rationalize.
The more you make excuses, it'll be easier to make excuses as you go.
Yeah. All right, so you've done foolishly. But look at verse 14. But now your kingdom shall not continue. That's pretty quick in this that God says, you're pretty much done. Now we know he served as king for 40 years. Okay? But again, when you're talking about this kingdom thing, you're talking about it continuing, you're talking about the thought of it continuing for generations. No son of Saul would ever sit on the throne of Israel. That's how drastic this is. And think about the consequences. Because we know at least about one son of Saul that was just a wonderful young man. Seemed to have a heart for God. He was loyal. Jonathan was not judged as being the next king of Israel upon what Jonathan had done. But his father had set that upon him in his disobedience. It's incredible when you start thinking about the consequences of even our own disobedience to God. And we all are disobedient. Let's just admit that right off. But how do we act when we are disobedient? And I've shared this with you probably several times, where people will come forward and they're just overcome with something in their life and their heart's broken that they've done something or said something or like that. And they weep before the Lord and say, "Pastor, I've done this awful thing and I don't even know if I'm a Christian." And my response usually is, the mere fact that you are here before God weeping, crying over what you've done, tells me that you belong to Him. You see, it's people, I worry more about people who can do what you did this week, the act that you did this week, and walk around like it doesn't mean anything, than I would ever worry about you who is here broken before God, asking God to forgive you. Because it always starts in the heart. Heart touched by the Holy Spirit of God. We're all capable, and we all do acts of disobedience. The question is, when the Holy Spirit convicts us of that, how do we respond? And if we try to self-justify, then we've got some issues in our relationship with God. And I'm not saying someone's not saved. I'm just saying we have some issues that need to be taken care of. Any thoughts, questions, or anything? All right, so he said the consequences of this, in verse 14, your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. Kind of a prophetic phrase, wouldn't you agree? Because of what's said about David later on. Okay? After his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Now, can you imagine, let's just take a minute, just from a human perspective, the blow that this must have been to Saul.
We hope it was.
Well, I think it was, because I also think what we see very quickly happen is he seems to be all of a sudden being tormented by evil spirits, even. And later on, you begin to see this. The resentment, he's a human being. He was set in this place by Samuel. I don't know that he even understands what he's done here. And I'm sure he's thinking, this is not fair. Okay, I did this one thing. You know, and he doesn't see the whole picture of what he actually has done. And he may not yet understand the consequences of someone that's been put in a high place of authority and the consequences of being disobedient in that place before God. So I think a lot of things are going to start building up in Saul from this point forward. And I think we see that as we read this, as we go on through the next things that begin to happen, there has to be a lot of resentment. The prophet says it's not going to be your kingdom. Matter of fact, God is already looking for your replacement. Okay? Nobody likes to hear that. You're a good guy, but we're already looking for your replacement. We got him on the back burner, you know. So, you know, okay, I'm going to do the best job I can do. I'm going to be happy here. He's a real man going through all of these things. Okay? Plus, you have to add, in this case, I think, the spiritual component that's going on here. Because I think what we see is, if a man who has the opportunity to be responsive to the Spirit of God, yet his heart shows that he's not going to be responsive, he's going to be responsive to some spirit. There's no middle ground here. Okay? So it's the same thing today, I believe. You know, it talks about in Romans chapter 1 when they rejected God and they did not worship Him to be God, but they were. It says that God Himself handed them over to a reprobate heart. He handed them over to the heart that they want. So they begin to do things that that are unnatural. And that's what I think we're going to see with Saul here as we go through this. So, verse 15. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeth. I'm trying to think, where is that Gibeth at? It's kind of, Gilgal's right on the border here, which would not be too far from where, Jericho. Okay, Gibeth would be a little bit more over between the sea and the Jordan River there. So he heads that way, and it talks about Gilgal, Gibeth of Benjamin. Here's the area of Benjamin. Benjamin and Judah were right there together at this time. And Saul numbered the people who were present with him, and there were about 600 men. Present with who? I assume it's with Saul. Would you agree? So who was left with Saul? 600 men. Which kind of leads you to believe what we talked about last week. The number, the huge number that were spoken of last week may not have been as exact in the translation as they actually were. Because you're starting...
There were 2,000.
Huh?
There were 2,000 at the beginning of the chapter.
3,000.
Yeah, 3,000 men.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 3, but when I'm really talking about the numbers they gave the Philistine with 30,000 chariots and and all that. That was just that would be, we talked about it, almost be an impossible number here. So, and that has to do more with the translation than it does with inaccuracies and stuff like that. So
Gilgal is where you have it, but. My translation calls it Gibeah, G-I-B-E-A-H, and it's actually just north of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Well, and so you go up from Gilead up to Gilgal because it's not even that far north. It's just a couple miles north of Jerusalem.
Yeah. And so you would have Jerusalem and Bethlehem.
Yep.
Right in here together. By the way, you always go up to Jerusalem.
Yep.
Even if you're coming from the north, you always go up to Jerusalem. So that may even be why they're talking about. But the mountains, I mean, the area right here that's the Judean wilderness and the Judean mountains right here.
Well, right next to the Jordan, where Jericho and Gilead are lowlands.
Yeah.
And then right away you start going up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600. Saul, now we have, I think it's the first time we've had him mentioned in this book. Jonathan, his son. Am I right about that? Okay, we have Jonathan brought into the scenario. Jonathan, his son, and the people who were present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped at Michmash. Now, I could not find Michmash.
My notes say they're about a mile apart.
Oh, okay. I see it on the map that you gave us. So, basically, this has, and I don't know, this has Michmash almost in between those two cities. If they're encamped there, it would lead me to believe also that you're talking probably about a mountain range or something. A high ground. They would be on the high ground. So they're. But anyway, to go from Gilgal to Gibeah, you got to go a certain way to get around where the Philistines are all. By the way, again, this land right here that we're talking about here could not handle 20,000 chariots. So. All right. So. The Philistines were encamped there. Verse 17, then raiders came from out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned to the road that leads to, I always want to say Oprah, but it's Ophrah, to the land of Shual. One company went, here's how they go, here they go. One company went up. That's where Ophrah is up here. Now, this is not the scale. Please understand that. One went to the north of where Gibeah was. So they sent one company like that to the north. Okay. Another company turned to the road of Beth Horah, I don't know that I have, oh yeah, Beth Horah would put him almost one kind of straight. That's where Beth Horah is over here. Actually, they have it over here closer to Ephraim. Okay, and another company turned to the road to the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboiim toward the wilderness. And let's see, one other thing. And I don't see that anywhere. My guess, though, is...
Well, one of my maps says the wilderness of Judah is right along that edge, south of where you're drawing.
Yeah.
Along the edge of the Dead Sea.
Right along. Right. And it would make sense that the one would come down this way. You just see the military decision there. What are they going to try to do? They're going to try to surround where Saul and his sons are. So that's basically what he's describing there for us, even though we don't know. Again, these are supposed sites on these maps and stuff, but it makes sense that what they're saying here is that what the Philistines are attempting to do is they're attempting to surround Saul and his sons. And we know where they're at. They're at Gibeth here in Benjamin. Okay? And so, as we close tonight, because our time's up, we close with, remember, Saul has been told the kingdom is going to be taken out of his hands. God's looking for someone else. I'm sure he's consumed with anger, frustration, just all the emotions are going on there. He and his 600 men at this time return to Gibeah, and now the Philistines seem to be moving to surround them. So that's where we are as we close out. They're in that Gibeah of Benjamin, which is his own. That's his region. Remember, he's of the tribe of Benjamin. That's his region. Okay, and now the Philistines are surrounding him, and we have to stop there. There's been a lot of